You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to For I Will Be With You. Reflections on recovery from the Bible. I am Baruch. I'm an alcoholic. I'll be your host today for the seventh week of the year, from February 12th to February 18th. We're going to cover Genesis 28:10 through Genesis 31:37. So, at the end of last week's podcast, we were at the moment where Jacob sort of steals the blessing from Isaac by dressing up as Esau, and he gets the blessing that's intended for Esau, the blessing of the eldest child, which confers upon him the right and the privilege to be the leader of the Israelite people. But he doesn't act on this right away because he's frightened of Esau, and Esau is actually threatening to kill him, so Jacob runs away. So it says in Genesis 28:10, Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran, Beersheba, as it's called in today in Israel. So and Haran is where Rebekah's family lives. It's where Laban, Rebekah's brother, is, and it's where Rachel and Leah, Laban's daughters, live. It's where Rebekah basically sends Jacob. Now, it says, the commentary says that Jacob did not go directly to Haran. Instead, they say he went and spent 14 years studying at the yeshiva. Yeshiva is like a Torah learning institute of Shem and Eber. Shem was Noah's son, and Eber was Noah's grandson. So it's just one thing maybe interesting to say is that Noah's son was still alive at this time, partly because, as we know in the book of Genesis, people lived a really, really long time. But that, you know, Abraham actually met Noah. Abraham was alive for the last 48 years of Noah's life. So there's sort of these events are closer together than we sometimes think. Certainly these people's lifespans overlapped, and Shem and Eber ran this academy, so to speak, where they taught the patriarchs. They taught Isaac, they taught Jacob the lessons of the Torah and of the God and the Bible. So the question, though, that gets asked is why did Jacob need to go to 14 more years of school? Basically, he was already a grown-up man, and he had spent his entire life, really, to date, learning Torah with his father, Isaac, who was tremendously learned. So why does he need to spend 14 more years learning? And what the sages say is that Jacob needed more learning, more preparation in Torah and understanding of God to survive morally and spiritually in the depraved world of Laban, in outside of the land of Israel. So it's one thing to live a life of Torah and God consciousness when you're living in Isaac and Rebekah's home. They're already some of the holiest people in history. But it's another thing to carry on and be holy yourself when you're not in that environment. So, you know, Jacob knew he was going to be with Laban, who was a crook, and he had to prepare himself spiritually. Now, we can learn something from this. We can extrapolate this concept and apply it to recovery, which is that we need to prepare ourselves to stay sober in the outside world. It's one thing to be, so for example, in rehab or, you know, a closely guarded kind of sober living environment, which is great. But when you're going to go out into life, back into life, you have to really prepare yourself. And and if we don't prepare ourselves, we might suffer in terms of recovery. And a lot of relapses occur, as we know. People, you know, go back to work or back to their families or back to their old neighborhood after rehab or after an intense recovery period, and then they relapse because they haven't prepared themselves properly, or they haven't continued to keep it up. So Jacob runs away, and in Genesis 28:12 we have a description of a dream that Jacob has. It's very famous. In fact, there's even a term in the English language for what he sees in this dream. It's called a Jacob's ladder. So it says, "And he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward, and behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it." Jacob has gone up to the top of a mountain. Some commentators say he's on the Temple Mount in what is now Jerusalem, although he doesn't know what it is. It's just a mountain, a hilltop for him at that point. He sets his head down on a group of stones as his pillow, and he dreams a dream of angels going up and down. And this is just a great metaphor for recovery on a lot of levels, and I really want to explore it. Because for one thing, like all of us, Jacob had angels with him. Angels helped him accomplish his purpose in life. But unlike you and I, Jacob had the ability to see them. He knew these angels were there. He could see them. You know, like you and I have angels who help us in our life and protect us, but they're invisible to us. Jacob could actually see them. And, you know, if we could know about the angels that God dispatches to help us and protect us in our lives, we might be more appreciative of the life we've been given. And this image of going up and down the ladder is a really great image for the way recovery works or doesn't work in our programs. Every day, we're either moving toward recovery or away from it. This is the choice we have to make. If we choose to ignore recovery, we inevitably go down the ladder, and our problem and our program suffers, and perhaps even to the point of relapse. Ignoring our program is equivalent to choosing to turn away from it, and no action is equivalent to negative action. And you hear this a lot in the rooms. If you're just sitting still, you're not doing anything, you're not going to meetings, you're not working on yourself, you're basically going backwards. And on the other hand, if you do the work and improve the program, you go up the ladder towards growth, recovery, spiritually, or as the dream suggests, back towards heaven, towards better conscious contact with our higher powers. So Jacob continues on his journey. He's going to Haran, where his family, his mother's family is, and he comes to a well. Now, as we know in the book of Genesis, many great couples meet at wells. Wells are like seems to be the place where men go to meet their future wives. And when Jacob gets to this particular well, he says, it's Genesis 29:2 says, "The stone over the mouth of the well, was large. When all the flocks would be assembled there, they would roll the stone off the mouth of the well and water the sheep. Then they would put back the stone over the mouth of the well in its place." So what this means is that there was a stone, there was a well of water for the sheep, but it was so big that one person couldn't roll it off by himself. They had to wait till all the shepherds got there, and then they would together roll the stone off of this well so they could water all the sheep together. And the interpretation of this is that these shepherds were suspicious of each other. They didn't trust each other not to take more than their fair share of water from the well. Now, I don't mean to trivialize the importance of something like water for a shepherd, but this speaks to character. They did not trust each other at all, and they had to be sure that they were all watching each other when they watered their sheep. And this is, if we can look at ourselves, this is real alcoholic behavior. You know, you don't trust anyone, and you only believe in what's mine is mine kind of attitude. And you know, the addiction can weigh us down like a stone that can't be budged. You know, or at least we may feel like the stone cannot move. But with God's help, we can move it. Because this is what happens. In the next verse, Genesis 29:10, Jacob is able to roll the stone off the well by himself. he shows up and rolls the stone off for Rachel's sheep. She's there by herself. So this is quite an interesting moment. So he, with God's help, he can roll that stone right off that well, which is something that would normally take several men. Because when God is with us, God gives us power to do things. Superhuman strength, so to speak. Maybe not physical strength, but moral strength, spiritual strength, energy, drive. This is just a quick digression. You know, the Bible often talks about stones and rocks. Mentioned just a minute ago about Jacob taking taking stones and using them as a pillow. When he had his dream, the commentary says that those stones fused together and became one stone, which became the altar. And if you look at the history of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, there's an emphasis on this stone that was there, that was kind of the special stone. That's the stone. And here we have a stone representing this obstacle of, you know, spiritual growth. And these stones and rocks come up a lot in the Bible, and we'll talk about them. But the idea is that the stone is a great example of something that sort of has no inherent, you know, use, like, other than like building with it or whatever. It's not valuable. It's a rock. There's an expression, dumb as a rock. Rocks are sort of dumb. But with God's help, they can become special. And I think that there's an idea we can nurture from there. You know, like, I think a lot of us, when we're in our drinking and acting out, our heads are, you know, full of rocks, so to speak. So what's it going to take to transform those rocks into something that's more useful to our lives? So Jacob meets Rachel, who's by the well, and Rachel has an older sister named Leah. They're both the daughters of Laban. They're basically his cousins. Rebecca is their aunt, so they're his first cousins. But he understands that he's intended to marry Rachel, and he asks. You know, there's this moment where Jacob meets Laban, and he loves Rachel very much, and he says, "I want to marry Rachel, and I'll work for you for 7 years." In order to marry Rachel, it's very clear. Now, the next thing that the Torah says is, or the next thing we're going to discuss, on 29:17, it says, Leah's eyes were tender. Now, what does this mean? One interpretation is that she had a vision problem. She was blind or partially blind or something. another interpretation is that her eyes were tender because she was almost always crying. Why was Leah crying so much? The explanation that's given is that Leah understood that Isaac and Rebekah had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and Laban had two daughters, Rachel and Leah, and that as the elder daughter, she was destined to marry the older brother. She was destined to marry Esau. And although she wasn't close to them, the word got around, and she knew that Esau was a bad guy, and she didn't want to marry him. I don't blame her, but she felt that this was her destiny, so she cried about this every day, because Leah wanted to marry Jacob. Leah wanted to be the matriarch of the Israelite people and the mother of the entire Judeo-Christian tradition. This was the slot that was up for grabs here. So she prayed. She prayed to God to change her destiny. She prayed and prayed, and she cried every day, and she wanted her life to be different. And what happened was, her life did get to be different. She got to marry Jacob. And then she was also allowed to do something that was not considered possible, or certainly wasn't common, which was to marry the same man as her sister. Because as we know from the Bible, Jacob married both Rachel and Leah. He married two sisters. So we'll just sidestep the emotional complexity of that kind of relationship. But he married both of them, and he had children with both of them, and their children became the 12 tribes of the Israelite nation. So what we can learn from this is that prayer can lead to miraculous results. She can be an inspiration to us, that we can change our lives and our futures through prayer. And I know, you know, when you look at recovery, there's people often come into recovery with a terrible sense of inevitability in their lives. You know, you hear these kind of stories like, well, you know, my parents were alcoholics. I started drinking at an early age. So my destiny in life was to be a drunk. Or another a comment I heard just recently, which was just incredible, an older man said, he said, you know, when I was 50 years old, I figured the rest of my life would consist of drinking and drinking until I drank myself to death. And that seemed like a pretty good plan to me at the time. And that's, you know, unfortunately, a lot of us have been at that kind of place. But this gentleman, I will tell you, his life is quite different now. Very, very full and rich life in sobriety. And he realizes that that wasn't his destiny. And I think he prayed, when he got aware of what was potentially there for him in life, he prayed fervently that it would happen for him, and it did happen. Of course, he had to do certain things on his own to make it happen too, but he was able to tap into his higher power and change his life. Now, what happens next is another well-known moment in the Bible, which is that Jacob marries who he thinks is Rachel. The woman is wearing a veil, and he's not exactly sure who it is. And they consummate the marriage, and when he wakes up, and there was no electric light in those days, so it was dark all night when he woke up, Genesis 29:25, and it says, "And it was in the morning that, behold, it was Leah." He realized in the morning that he'd married the wrong woman, or maybe to be more precise, the wrong woman had been substituted for his intended wife without his knowledge. Laban has tricked him. And they quickly come up with another deal that Jacob will work another short 7 years in order to marry Rachel, who he originally thought he was working the first 7 years for. Now, this is another confusing incident, because you wonder, how can a man not know who he's marrying? One of the explanations is that in those days there was tremendous modesty, and that men, he probably didn't see these women very much. He certainly would have had no idea what they really looked like with their clothes off or whatever. I mean, you know, it's not surprising, and she was wearing a veil, and it was dark. There's another interpretation, though, of this story that is really profound, which is that this was not a big surprise. Rachel knew that her father was a crook, and Jacob knew that Laban was a crook, and they also knew that Leah wanted to marry Jacob. So they were working with open secrets. So what Rachel and Jacob did was they developed like a secret code word that they would use. So like on the wedding night, you know, you ask me this word, and if I respond, even though I'm wearing a veil, you'll know it's me. You'll know it's me, Rachel. So what happens? They used this system, but it didn't work. Why not? And this is just an amazing story. This is from the commentary. Rachel realized that if Leah married Jacob and Jacob became, you know, unhappy with this and was unpleasantly surprised, that this would cause her sister tremendous embarrassment. And think about how humiliating that would be on your wedding night as a woman to be married and have your husband say, "Who are you? I didn't agree to this. This is an outrage. I've been ripped off, blah, blah, blah." It would be humiliating. So to save her sister embarrassment, Rachel gave Leah the secret code word. So here's Jacob on his wedding night with a woman in a veil in the dark. He says, you know, "Psst, what's the special code word?" And the woman says the code word. And he goes, "Okay, this is Rachel. This is the woman I agreed to marry. I'm going to proceed and consummate the marriage." And he doesn't realize he's just done it with the wrong woman, because her sister gave her the code word. So there's a lesson in this. Because Rachel, it's very easy to look at it superficially, like, okay, she didn't want her sister to get embarrassed, so she gave her the code word. There's a lot more to it than that. By giving her sister the code word, she's letting her sister marry Jacob, the man whom she loves and the man whom she wants to marry. And she has no way of knowing that she'll be allowed to marry him too. As far as Rachel knows, once Leah marries Jacob, that's it. That's going to be the marriage, and she'll have to marry someone else. And she will have given up, A, the man she loves, B, the right and opportunity to be the mother of the Israelite nation and the mother of the entire Judeo-Christian tradition. She knows she is willing to give up these two immense things just to help her sister avoid a couple of minutes of being embarrassed. This shows there's a Torah concept. Helping someone else avoid embarrassment is one of the highest forms of service to God and service to another human being. Taking care of someone else's feelings is critically important, and this is a great lesson. If Rachel is willing to give up, she's basically throw her whole life away so that her sister won't feel embarrassed for a couple of minutes, then think about how maybe we could act differently with people, avoid embarrassing people or situations that might hurt someone else's feelings. This can help us a lot in recovery. But Jacob does, confront Laban because he's not, he is upset that he got tricked. And he, goes to Laban and says, what happened? This is ridiculous. I promised to work for you for 7 years for free in order to marry your younger daughter, and I've been married to your older daughter now. And what happened? So Laban says to him in Genesis 29:26, "Such is not done in our place to give the younger in marriage before the older." And this is a textbook case of alcoholic behavior. He's called on doing something dishonest, and he blames someone else. He says, instead of saying, "I won't allow this to happen," instead of taking responsibility for saying, "I didn't want my daughter to marry you, I wanted the older daughter to marry you first," he makes his cheating part of the common culture. "Such is not done," he says, And it also degrades Jacob, who's been totally honest about what he wants to do and followed through on his intention to work for 7 years. And Laban is also saying, "Are you like such an idiot that you didn't know that such is not done in our place?" Despite the fact that he made a promise to the contrary. And, I think that a lot of us have acted this way from time to time. When, we do something that we know is wrong, and our response is to say, "Hey, that's the way things happen around here. Everybody gets drunk every day at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Don't you know that? What's your problem? I'm just doing what everyone else does. Don't blame me, I have no problem," right? We've all, I think, been through that kind of moment. So then, later, let's cut to many years later. Jacob has married Leah and Rachel, and he's also married their two maidservants, Zilpah and Bilhah, and he's had 12 sons. And he decides to leave Laban. Finally, he's going to go back move on his own. He's going to confront Esau. And what happens is that Laban comes after him, claiming that something has been stolen from his house, which is also kind of funny because Laban is a huge crook and has been stealing from Jacob for years, tricking him, changing his pay, not giving him what he's entitled to. But here he is, he's charging after Jacob and this clan. And Jacob finally gets angry with Laban. I think this confrontation takes place somewhere on the road. They've left Haran, and Laban has come galloping up demanding that his property be returned. Jacob says, Genesis 31:36 and 37 say, "Then Jacob became angered, and he took up his grievance with Laban. Jacob spoke up and said to Laban, 'What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? When you rummaged through all my things, what did you find of all your household's objects? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, and let them decide between the two of us.'" He's saying, what have you doing? What are you looking for? So Laban was a huge crook and chiseler, cheated Jacob. Yet we see in this verse and elsewhere that Jacob never was anything less than totally honest with Laban. In fact, commentators say that Jacob was strictly honest with his work and not, not allocating anything to himself that he shouldn't. He was rigorously honest. And, you know, maybe for us thinking about this, maybe our lives could have been different if we could have emulated Jacob a little bit in our affairs. Because I think in many of our stories, we have a little bit of, you know, I'll take a little extra for myself, you know, because I deserve it, even if I don't. And I think in recovery, this comes up as a concept of keeping your side of the street clean, despite what anyone else does or says. And don't let the immorality of others serve as an excuse for misbehavior. Because I think a classic alcoholic way of thinking is, well, you know, my boss is a crook, so I get to be a crook too. Jacob shows us the opposite. His boss was a crook, but he acted honestly. He kept in touch with God. He kept his side of the street clean. So we can learn from this. Let's not take a tit-for-tat attitude, no matter what anyone else does to us, because we hurt our own selves by acting in this way. And we should just take it as a role, and take Jacob as a role model to keep our side of the street clean.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast, daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com